Good morning, ladies. We are studying today, Erev Shabbat, we are studying Parashat Masa'eh. This will be the last Parashah in the book of Bamidbar. God willing, next week we start the fifth and final book of our Torah, the book of Devarim. This week would be the conclusion of the fourth book of the Torah, the book of Bamidbar. I'd like to point out that this is actually a rare occasion that a lecturer gives a class on the Parashah of Masa'eh. Why is it rare? Because usually last week's Parashah and this week's Parashah are read together. Usually these two Parashiyot, Matot, which was last week, and this week Masa'eh, usually they're combined. Very rarely are they separated. This year, because of the leap year and other calculations, the Parashah is read on its own. The first 50 Pesukim of the Parashah actually are a list of places, the names of places, where the Jewish people traveled through their 40-year journey in the desert. Let's remind ourselves, for 40 years the Jewish people traveled in the Midbar after they left Egypt, and their sojourn lasted them 40 years until they entered Eretz Israel. So in 40 years there was 42 station stops. During the route, they camped in 42 different places. And the Torah, this week's Parashah, gives us a detailed list of the schedule. They went to this place, they landed, then they went to another place, and they landed, and they went, and they traveled to a different place. Every pasuk starts off, Vayis'u, Vayahanu. And they traveled, and then they camped. Vayis'u, Vayahanu. And then they traveled, and then they camped. 42 different places in the Torah, like I told you, gives us all the names of these places. Somebody might ask, what is the purpose for me to know that the Jewish people stopped at 42 different stations before they got to Israel? And why would the Torah spend 50 pesukim to discuss seemingly superfluous information? What do we gain by knowing the different places that the Jewish people traveled to and camped in before they got to Israel? Rashi has one answer to this question. Rashi says it comes to show us the love that God has for the Jewish people. Because if you make a calculation, 40 years to only stop at 42 places is like an average of one stop per year. That's not bad. And if you really break it down, the calculation really is that in 38 years of the 40, they only traveled to 20 places. So they did 20 stops in 38 years. So that's really a very slow pace of traveling. And therefore it shows God's compassion that He didn't want to overburden us in our travelings. So therefore, we had to move at a very slow pace because God wanted us to be rested and not to overburden us in the Midbar. So one reason why the Torah would list this to us is to show us God's compassion to the Jewish people in the desert. The Ramban has a different approach. The Ramban says that we believe that our existence in the Midbar was supernatural. It had to be supernatural. You can't plant any vegetation in the desert. It won't grow. There is no water in the desert. So how did the Jewish people sustain themselves? How did they eat? How did they drink? So the Torah clearly tells us that the man rained from heaven every day. They had the heavenly bread. They had a certain well, the well of Miriam, that used to travel with them throughout their travelings in the Midbar. It was all miraculous, it was supernatural. But somebody might be skeptical, somebody might be a little cynical, and say, who says it was miraculous? Maybe they traveled next to cities. Maybe God made it that when they traveled, they were always next to a civilized country. So they always had water and food to their disposal. Who said that it was so awesome and so amazing how the Jewish people existed in the Midbar? Maybe it wasn't supernatural at all. Maybe the Jewish people always traveled next to a food station. So the Torah goes out of its way to tell us the route. These are the places they traveled. Go look on the map until today at all these stops that the Jewish people made, and you'll see, says the Rabban, they're in the middle of nowhere. They're not next to any civilization. They're not next to any people or any society that was living. And therefore you can prove it from the fact that the Torah gives us a detailed list of where they were, that it had to be that they lived through a nes, they lived through a miracle. And therefore, this is to answer the cynic. This is to answer the cynical person that comes to second guess, did God really perform all these miracles? These 42 station stops prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that we were close to no formal society. And therefore, the only way we were able to exist must have been by God providing for us the man and the well of Miriam. Those are the opinions of Rashi and Ramban. But with your permission today, ladies, I'd like to offer a third explanation, maybe why the Torah goes out of its way to list to us the 42 places. When the Jewish people came out of Egypt, Hachamim tell us we were on a very low level of spirituality. You have to remember, we lived in a foreign country, void of morals and values, for 210 years. Over two centuries we lived side by side with the most decadent people. The Egyptians, as the Torah tells us, were a perverted people. They were involved in all sorts of abominations. And even though the Jews kept to themselves, and we did retain a certain identity, but still through osmosis, we definitely were affected by the society of Egypt. Now we left Pesach. We left Egypt, we had the Exodus. We weren't spiritually ready to go into Israel. It would have been too much too fast. It would have been like an overload. To go from the lowest level and all of a sudden have to move into Israel to the highest spiritual level, it would be an overload on their spirituality. And therefore God said that He needs to gradually elevate them in order that they'll be able to enter the land of Israel. All these station stops that the Torah mentions to us, things happened at these stations. For example, at one station we received the Torah. At another station we complained to God and God answered us. At another station we spoke Lashon Hara when we sent the spies. Each place was another learning experience. Each place was another test where we learned from it and we grew from it. And it took 42 different lessons that God had to give us in order for us to reach spiritual maturity. And it's something that was necessary. And that's when the Pasuk writes, Vayis'u, and they traveled, Vayahanu. And only after they traveled and they settled, and they received the lesson of that place, then they were able to travel. Vayis'u, they traveled yet again. Vayahanu, and then they settled. And once they learned the lesson of the second place, they were able to travel again. But they needed this lengthy course, because for them it was a period of spiritual growth. Each encampment was another step in this process of spiritual development. And this is a very important lesson, ladies. All of us that are involved in spiritual growth must remember that it cannot be done in one leap. Growing in religion must be done gradually. It must be done in increments. It's like an amateur violinist that wants to play a complex concerto. It's impossible. It takes years and years of practice in order for him to develop the skills. It's the same thing in religion. You know, many times people become Baalei Teshuvah, they just repent. You know, they see the light, they want to become more religious. And many times these young men come to me and say, Rabbi, I want to study Kabbalah.
Kabbalah?
Yes, the mysticism, the Zohar. I said, did you study the Torah yet? Did you study the Parashah? Read the Parashah. I want to study Kabbalah. I want to study Zohar. Now, of course, we cannot teach Zohar on the first day. Hakamim tell us you have to be at least 40 years old before you can even attempt to understand the Zohar. And 40 years old is only one prerequisite. You have to be fluent in the entire five books of Moses, in the entire Navi, in the entire scriptures. You must be fluent in the entire Talmud and have a clear knowledge of the Shulchan Aruch, which is our law book. Incidentally, to have fluency in all those books takes a lifetime on its own. Only after you have fluency in all these books, now you can start with Kabbalah. But to start with the mysticism and the esoteric areas of our Torah on day one, you'll overload. It's too much too fast. Usually what happens to people like that accept too much upon themselves, they can do it for a month or two. And if they have good stamina, they can do it even for 3 or 4 months. But what usually ends up happening is they crash. Eventually they fall out and it is too much, it's too difficult. And therefore, if you want to be successful in your religious pursuit, you must see to it that it is done after you have reached a solidified position, then you can go to the next position. And it must be done slowly. You know, there is a great rabbi, Rabbi Tversky, who's involved in counseling drug addicts, drug addiction. One of the addicts that he deals with is the alcoholic. And there is a patented program for alcoholics that they call the 12-step program. It was 12 steps in order to bring them to sobriety. So he has a sign in his office, Rabbi Tversky, to all his patients. And the sign says, the elevator to recovery is out of order. Please use the 12 steps. And that sign can be used as well for religion. The elevator for religion is out of order. You must use the steps, which means it's gradual, it's slowly. Every year you accept upon yourself something else, a different law, a different behavior pattern. So long as you're constantly growing, you're going in the right direction. So long as you look at yourself where you are today, and you look at yourself where you were last year, if you find yourself better, you're doing fine. The Torah does not demand for us to reach 0 to 100 in 1 second. The Torah demands for us to be traveling towards 100. So long as you're in the north direction, going up, you're doing fine. Some people can travel faster, some a little slow, but nobody is able to do it overnight. Hence, the Torah is teaching us a great lesson. Even the Jews in the Midbar, this was a generation that had a great teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu. You figured Moshe Rabbeinu would be able to accelerate the process. No, sirree. Even the Jews in the Midbar, with a teacher like Moshe Rabbeinu, it took 40 years, 42 different stops. At each stop, they learned another lesson of life, and only then were they prepared to enter the land of Israel. Again, spirituality is a gradual process. One of the station stops that they made, the Torah tells us, and I read it in the Pasuk, Bayahanu b'mara. They got to a city that was called Mara. Why was it called Mara? Our Parashah doesn't tell us this. But earlier in the Torah, Parashat B'Shalach, it tells us why they called it Mara. Does anybody know what Mara means? On Pesach, we eat Maror. Maror is something that's bitter. Mara, the name of the city was bitterness. What a morbid name to a city. Who would call such a city bitterness? So the Torah tells us why they called it Mara. If you remember when we got to that spot, it says there was water. And the Jewish people were thirsty. But it says, V'lo yachlu l'shtot mayim. Mimara, they weren't able to drink the waters at Mara, kimarim hem, because the waters were bitter. The Torah says, Al Ken Kadash Shemo Malach. So they named the place bitterness. Why? Because the water in that place was bitter. So I read an explanation from the rabbi called Baal Shem Tov. He has a little different spin on that pasuk. He says they couldn't drink the waters of Mara because they were bitter. He says the they is not referring to the water. The they is referring to the people. The people were bitter. The people were in a state of depression. When a person is dejected, when a person is in a bad mood, everything around them seems to be bitter, no matter how sweet it is. The Torah is coming to teach us a great lesson, that bitterness is subjective. A person can be looking at the most beautiful thing, but if his attitude is bad, if he's upset, if he's in a bad mood, if he's involved in dejection or depression, his perception on life is skewed. He's not able to see things as they truly are. Life becomes bitter. And I'm not saying this as a figure of speech. The psychologists tell us that a person that has a depression, his food tastes bitter to him. Which means it's a physical thing. Which is even the food that a person that's upset, he'll eat food, they won't be able to taste the sweetness of the food. Even the food that one eats is affected by a person's attitude. We have a famous story to prove this. Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, she was in the field with her son. Her son was dying of thirst. You remember the story. And she couldn't see her son die. She said, my son is going to die of dehydration. I cannot watch this with my own eyes. So what did she do? She ran away. And as she was running away, the pasuk writes, God opened her eyes. Vayifka Hashem et aineha. God opened the eyes of Hagar. And behold, she saw an oasis. She saw water. So the rabbis comment. What do you mean, God opened her eyes and she saw the water? It sounds like the water was always there. It's just for some reason, Hagar didn't see it. Until God opened her eyes, now she was able to see something that was there from the beginning. Why wasn't she able to see the water? Because she was so upset. Because she was so bitter at what was taking place to her son, that her perception was grossly distorted. She wasn't even able to see a beracha that was in front of her. From here you see how dangerous it can be to make decisions on life when you're not in the proper state of mind. You have to be very careful. Because things are not seen to us in the proper light when we're not in the proper mood. The Jewish people drank that water. You know why it tasted bitter to them? Not because the water was bitter. Because they were bitter. Because their attitude was bad. That everything around them is perceived in a bad light. That's why our Torah places such an importance on being happy. There's no bigger mitzvah in the Torah than to be in a good mood. Than to have a positive disposition. Because based on your disposition, that's going to affect all the decisions that you make in life. That's going to be the basis of how you understand everything in life. And the advice that you take for yourselves. I remember myself, when I was studying in the yeshiva at one point, there was one point where I contemplated to leave the yeshiva. To leave the yeshiva and to go out and become a businessman. So I went to the rabbi. And I sat with the rabbi and I told him, this is what I'm thinking. So the rabbi, in his genius, he did not reject my feelings. He said, I understand what you're saying. But I don't think in the state that you're in now, you're capable of making such a decision. So why do you say that? He says, you look upset. You look depressed. You don't look happy. In such a state, it's not fair to make such a life decision. Because you're seeing everything black. You're seeing everything bad. Get out of this state of depression that you're in. Get yourself back into a good mood Then you'll be able to see both sides a little clearer. Then you can make the decision. The rabbi said, I'm not telling you don't make a decision, but you cannot make a decision when you're in such a state. It's not fair to yourself. You're seeing it the wrong way. And that rabbi was 100% right. I went back to the yeshiva, and through the studying of Torah, I was able to pick myself up. And once my mood changed, right away I saw the two sides much clearer. And I said to myself, thank God I did not make such a snap decision when I was holding by such a mood. Because it would have been a life mistake on my part had I let my negative attitude affect my decision making. And that's a very important lesson in life as well. To keep our attitudes balanced. The only question is, how do you do that? How do you do that? If we go back to that story, when the waters were bitter at Marah, God tells Moshe, go sweeten the waters. Should have been, how do I sweeten the waters? God says, take a stick, take an ace, a tree, and throw it in the water. It's strange. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes, takes a stick, he threw it in the water, and the pasuk says, "Vayimtekhu amayim," the water became sweetened. Miracle of miracles, a branch was able to sweeten millions of gallons of water. There's no way you can explain this. It's an open miracle. So we can explain this pasuk a little differently. You've heard me say in a previous class that our Torah is called Etz Chaim. It's called the tree of life. Because when one studies Torah, he gets wisdom. The Torah gives you faith. The Torah gives you serenity and tranquility and the ability to understand things that most people can't understand. When most people see things in life and they complain about it and they're upset about it, those that study Torah are able to accept. The Torah teaches a person the ability to accept things, to deal with things. The Torah is like a therapy that gives people the ability to cope. There's nothing more soothing to the soul and the mind than a Torah class. It's concepts. It's like medicine. There's a certain calming effect when one studies Torah. Do you know, in a week from Sunday, we're going to commemorate the Tisha B'Av, and one of the laws of the Tisha B'Av is that the men, or the ladies for that matter as well, are not allowed to study Torah. Imagine that there's a day of the year where Torah study is forbidden. Forbidden to study Torah. Why? Because the Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning, it's a day of sorrow, and Torah is soothing. The Torah is an addiction, it's pleasurable. There's a certain sensation of calmness that one has when they learn. And that is not what one should do on a national day of mourning. That is not what one should do on a day where our people mourn the destruction of its two temples. And therefore, the way to bring a person to this happiness that we're talking about, to this good mood, you gotta learn. When your soul is content, your body is content. How many times people wake up and they're just in a bad mood? Where does bad mood come from? A lot of times it comes from because the soul of a person's body is being deprived from its nutrients. And it reacts. The body gives us warning signs. You know what the warning signs of spiritual deprivation is? Depression. When a person finds themselves chronically in a bad mood, it's because they're not feeding their soul. It's scurvy of the neshama. And then when one starts to study, you start to feel, you feel good. You start to feel satiated. You feel accomplished. The Torah tells us, God told Moshe, you want to sweeten the waters? You want to change the attitudes of these bitter people? Take an etz. What is the etz? Etz Chaim. Let them learn. Let them study. The Etz Chaim can change an attitude. Hence, Vayimtekhu Amayim. So at that place of Marah, Jewish people learned a very therapeutic lesson. They learned the lesson of attitude. Now, attitude is so important. And a good attitude is so important. I want to point out that right after they left Marah, the Pasuk writes in Parashat Mishalach, God says, Ani Hashem Rofecha, I am God, your doctor. It's very interesting that in that parasha it talks about God being our doctor. This was therapy. God says, I'm your doctor, I'm going to heal you, not only from your physical wounds, but from your emotional problems. What was the next place we went to after Mara? The Pasuk tells us in this week's parasha, we got to the place called Elim. Okay, it's the name of the place, Elim. Any significance to the place of Elim to any of you? No. We never went there. What is Elim? Torah tells us, oh, in Elim, you should know, Shtem Esle Enot Mayim. There were 12 springs of water in Elim, the Shivrim Temarim, and 70 date trees. That's what Torah is telling us. I have to know that there were 12 springs in Elim and 70 date trees. It's not like we were checking into a hotel where the Torah has to tell us the scene, how many lounges were there, what type of pool was it. What was the Torah giving us this information over here? How many trees were there and how many springs? You know what the explanation is? Realistically, ladies, can 70 trees of dates feed 3 million people? Of course not. Not enough dates on 70 trees to feed the entire nation. Can 12 springs give enough water for 3 million people? In all probability, no. But you know what happened? When the Jewish people got to Elim, they said, huh? Beautiful! 70 trees, 12 springs of water. What happened to the attitude? They were cured. They just came from Mara. God taught them the importance of a good attitude. Because when one has a good attitude, even things that are not perfect, you can accept. Instead of saying, God, what'd you do with us? 70 trees, how are we going to live on 70 trees? They said, Baruch Hashem, 70 trees, it's fine. Beracha, it'll work out. God, 12 springs of water with 3 million people, it's not enough. They didn't say that. So the lesson of Mara was effective. So you see the gradual spiritual progression. They were cured in Mara from that emotional bitterness. When they got to the next place, they already accepted things as they were. And then when the Torah went out of its way to tell us how many trees there were and how many springs there were. The Torah then tells us the Jewish people traveled from Midbar Sinai. Midbar Sinai is the place that they received the Torah. Sinai. And what was the next station after Midbar Sinai? So they traveled to a place called Kibrot HaTa'ava. Literally, Kibrot HaTa'ava means the graves of cravings. Ta'ava is like desire. That was the name of the place. It wasn't the official name of the place. Nobody would name a place graves of cravings or graves of passion. But the reason why they called it that is because at that place the Jewish people started to complain. They wanted meat. They weren't happy with the menu. Seems Jews are never happy with the menu, even in the times of the Midbar. So they're complaining, they wanted different food. So the Torah says they named the place Kibrot HaTa'ava, the place where the Jewish people had cravings. But I saw an explanation. When did the cravings begin? Right after they left Midbar Sinai. Right after they left the encampment where they received the Torah. You know what you learn from here? That there is a direct correlation between the study of Torah and the suppressing or the controlling or the curbing of one's appetite towards their passion and their desires. So long as one is learning Torah and one is involved in religion, his passion is mitigated. He has control over himself. The Torah teaches self-restraint. But let me tell you something. When one stops learning Torah, he's automatically going to fall into his passion. There is no safety. There is no control. The second they left Midbar Sinai, where do they end up? In Kibrot HaTa'ava, in the graves of craving. We must teach this to our children. It's not enough to reprimand our children, don't take drugs. It's not enough to reprimand our children, don't eat in this place, or don't act like that. If we don't give them a certain restraining feature. We don't give them a certain way to control it. Words are not enough. Just to tell them don't do it is not enough. You have to give them a certain remedy that they can control themselves. It only comes from Torah. Tell your children to go to class. Tell your children to study. To attend the session of learning. To attend the synagogue. Then already their passion becomes curbed. All the therapy in the world without spiritual intervention does not work. The Jewish people left Midbar Sinai. Once you leave Sinai, once you leave the Torah, the next station is Gebrot HaTa'avah. The next station is passion and desire. We learned earlier in the book, in the Humash, that when the brothers threw Yosef into the pit, it says the pit was empty. There was no water in the pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water. So the rabbis tell us, yes, there was no water in the pit, but there was something else in the pit. Snakes and scorpions. And our rabbis learned a lesson from the pit that Yosef was thrown into. Water there wasn't in the pit, but snakes and scorpions there was. A person's mind is also like a pit. It's a cavity. It doesn't hold water, it holds our brain. However, if the cavity of the mind is devoid from water, spiritual waters of Torah, don't think that the mind is a vacuum. If there's no water of Torah in the brain, something else will occupy it. And what is that something else? Snakes and scorpions. Usually something that's bad. A person thinks, I don't learn Torah, but my mind is filled with good things. Impossible. The society outside these doors is filled with a lot of bad things, a lot of snakes and a lot of scorpions. And the only way that our minds will be flush from all these bad things is we insert and inject into our minds mayim, the Torah spiritual waters. And don't think if our children do not study, they are going to be subject to the vices of the world. We must inject into their minds the spiritual waters of Torah in order that the snakes and scorpions do not have room to enter. We must advise them to go to the classes. We must advise yourselves to attend classes. God forbid, look at the world today. For those people that haven't found this addiction called Torah, they're finding all other addictions. And those addictions are harmful. This addiction is good. This addiction can only benefit you. The more one becomes addicted to Torah, the better off he is. You don't need rehabilitation from Torah addiction. But if you don't have this addiction, you're subject to all the others. The moment you leave Sinai, Kibrot HaTa'avah is the next stop. Passion and desire. Torah has the ability to weaken that passion. Let me tell you a story from the Talmud. I'm so glad that we can get together on Fridays that you can hear these stories of the Talmud. It's so important that you know these stories. These are stories you can tell over to your children as well. There was a fellow, and I say a fellow because he originally was just a fellow. He was actually the head of the mafia. His name was Shimon ben Lakish. He was swimming one day. He looked over the river where he was swimming, and he saw a beautiful lady. And he said, I must have this lady. And he jumped from one side of the river to the other side of the river. He took a very great leap, an Olympic leap. He jumped to the other side, he lands, and to his dismay, he sees that what he thought beautiful lady was actually a man. None other than one of the most handsome rabbis, Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan says, wow, what was that all that you jumped from? He says, yeah, I thought you were a lady. So Rabbi Yochanan says, the truth, I have a sister, she's prettier than me. If you accept upon yourself to make teshuvah, if you accept upon yourself a resolute conviction to repent from your ways, after all, he was the head of the mafia, you can marry her. So Shimon ben Lakish thought about it, and he made a true commitment. How do we know it was a true commitment? What happened was, now he had to go back to the other side, I guess, to get his tote bag, to get his clothes. So he tried to jump to the other side, but he wasn't able to. So Rish Lakish said, what happened to me? A moment ago I was able to make a quantum leap, and now I'm unable. I become weakened. And Rabbi Yochanan said, that shows me that your resolution was true. Because Torah weakens the passion of a person. Torah has the ability to weaken the physical part of man. It doesn't mean that once you start learning, you're not able to lift a 10-pound weight anymore. It doesn't mean that. But what was driving Rish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish? He eventually became a great rabbi. He became the brother-in-law of Rabbi Yochanan. Originally, before Rish Lakish accepted Torah, his physical strength was able to drive him to jump from one side of a river to another to fulfill his yetzer hara, to go after a pretty woman. But now, if he accepted Torah, the power of Torah weakened him. Now already his desire was not the same. It became smaller. Just the acceptance of Torah, not even learning, just the fact that he accepted, already his yetzer hara shrunk. No longer was he able to jump on the others to the other side. Torah weakens the physical part of man. And in our generation, we could use any aid that'll help us weaken the physical passion. Because the desires in this world, especially where we live, are all around us. The temptation is so great. We can use any available tool to help us curb our desire and pleasure. Torah is that aid. The acceptance of Torah is able to control us from giving in, from succumbing to the desires that we shouldn't involve ourselves in. Vayisumi Midbar Sinai. That warns us to Torah. Leave Midbar Sinai once you leave Sinai. The next station is the station of forbidden cravings. But I know some of you will ask, Rabbi, that's good for when we're in the class. When we're in the class, we feel inspired. The Yetzer Hara has no control over us. But we can't stay in class all day long. Even though the Torah tells us, you're supposed to think of the Vre Torah wherever you are. Even when a person is traveling on the street, he has to be thinking of the Vnei Torah. A person is walking in the streets of Manhattan, he puts a Walkman on, he has a class, he's listening. Now it occupies his mind, Torah. The moment he takes that Walkman off, what occupies his mind? Snakes and scorpions. And then he sees all the billboards, and he sees all the different signs, and all the different mass marketing, and all the materialism. That's how dangerous it is. But Rabbi, are you telling us that we have to think of the Vrit Torah 24 hours a day? I think that's impossible. Most people cannot think of the Vrit Torah every single moment. So is there another advice? The next pasuk. Vayitzu mikevrot ha-ta'ava. The next station after kevrot ha-ta'ava was Vayachanu b'haserot. They reached a place called Haserot. In Hebrew, the word for a courtyard, or like a porch, is haser. A house is called a bayit. And a courtyard is called a haser. We all agree, nobody lives in a courtyard. You live in a house. A courtyard is a temporary residence. You sit outside on a sunny day for a couple of minutes. You might, you know, walk on the courtyard just to breathe some fresh air, but eventually you go back to your permanent dwelling. Nobody lives in a courtyard. You know what the Torah is telling you? If you want to control your passion outside the class, remember that you are living in a courtyard. This world is a courtyard. It's a temporary residence. It's not our permanent dwelling place. We come here for 120 years in order to prepare for our permanent, infinite existence in Olam Abba. When one remembers the ephemeral nature of this world, they'll say, what am I going after my passions for? The party is not here. The party is in Olam Abba. Why am I wasting all my pleasure here and minimizing my success to enjoy in the permanent world. One must always remember the temporary nature of this world. And we get fooled. You know why we get fooled? Because we have homes that we all built that last, they can last for 200 years, our homes. They're solid brick homes. We have suits that can last 10 years, each suit today that's made out of the finest garments. We have cars that are sturdy. We have roads that last for many years. The world looks very permanent to us. But don't be fooled. If we really knew the temporariness of this world, we would live like the Hafez Chaim. One time a businessman came to the Hafez Chaim. And he saw the Hafez Chaim lives very modestly. So he said, Rabbi, let me provide for you better living conditions. It's too small, it's too cramped the way you live. So the Hafez Chaim said, where are you living now? He said, well, I'm staying in a hotel.
Hotel?
How big is your hotel room? That's just one room. One room? You mean you don't have a living room, a dining room, a den? Rabbi, I don't need that. I'm on a business trip. I'm only here for 2 weeks. A hotel room is sufficient. My home, my permanent residence, I have a big house. The Hafez Chaim said, I'm on a business trip also. This is a trip that I'm on. This is my hotel room. My permanent residence is not in this world. My permanent residence is Olam Abba. All of us cannot live on the standard of the Hafez Chaim, I agree. And I'm not telling you to live in a small home or quarantine off where you're then and only live in confined quarters. But our attitude has to be like the Hafez Chaim. We must remember from time to time that this is not the game. This is only practice. It's even more than practice. This is the area, the staging area where we enter Olam Abba. Our rabbi said it the best when they said, the world is a vestibule. It's a hallway, it's a corridor that leads to the ballroom. Prepare yourself in the hallway to enter the ballroom. The problem is most of us think that this is the ballroom. Most of us think that this is it. And therefore we live like the Romans. Eat and be merry today, for tomorrow you shall die. Of course, if you don't believe in an afterlife, then of course you might as well enjoy it now, because there's nothing to look forward to. There was one fellow, he was on a plane, and there was turbulence on the plane. And it was scary turbulence. And everybody is nervous, and the Jews are taking out the Tehillim, and they're reading, and their heart is in their hand. And this fellow is pushing the button to call the stewardess. And the stewardess, of course, comes up. She's concerned, maybe something's wrong with him. And he says, I need a double shot of scotch. So the stewardess says, now? Now you call us in the middle of this crisis? So the fellow says, this might be the last drink that I ever have. I have to enjoy it. We might crash. That's the attitude of somebody that believes that they only live once. They have to get their last drink in. They have to get their last pleasure in. But Jews don't have that attitude. We believe that this is just a hallway. This is a courtyard. Our permanent residence is there. My rabbis once gave me a great example of a fellow that was born in the South. We might call him like a hick. He never went to a city wedding before. He didn't even own a tuxedo. And all of a sudden he has a distant cousin that lives in New York, and he sends him an invitation to a wedding at the Waldorf Astoria. Beautiful posh hotel. So the fellow from the South can't believe it. He's now going to go to New York for the first time to a wedding in the most prestigious hotel. He buys himself a tuxedo. He travels with his wife. The invitation says 6 o'clock. He's there at 5 o'clock. And he really doesn't know the formalities of a wedding. And he's a hick. He doesn't have any culture. And he gets to the wedding and he walks in and he has his invitation in his pocket. He doesn't know. Maybe he has to show ID. And now he's sitting in the lobby, in the hall, and a lady comes and she's serving little pieces of meat. So she offers him. So the fellow says, no, I don't have any money on me.
So they said, no, you don't have to pay for this. This is a wedding. Are you part of the wedding? He takes out an invitation. Yeah, look, I'm indicted. Okay, so you can take. He says, I can take. How many can I take? He doesn't have class. He doesn't know what this is. How many could you take? You can take as many as you want. He says, I'll take the whole thing. So the waitress is a little taken back. The guy takes the whole thing. He's 30 kibbit. And he can't believe it. He tells us, you believe this? What a wedding! Thinking about free kibbeh like that without even asking, no charge. We never saw such food like this. All of a sudden, another lady's walking around. She's carrying a little plate of lamadji. So they come to the guy. He's the only guy there. It's 5 o'clock. So he says, is this for taking? Of course for taking. He says, how much can I take? I mean, you take the whole thing. I'll take the whole thing. Takes the whole thing. He saw 30 lamadji in the guy. And every lady that walks by, waitress, he eats and he's telling his wife, you believe this? This is the greatest wedding we ever went to. But he says, I'm thirsty. There must be a Pepsi machine somewhere in this hotel. He doesn't know about Pepsi machines. He's going to buy a soda in the middle of the Waldorf Astoria. So as he's walking to look for a Pepsi machine, he sees a bar. A small little bar station. There's a bartender standing there. So the bartender says, can I get you a drink? He says, no, I'm sorry, I don't have any money for a drink. You have any money? You invited to the wedding? He says, there is an invitation. Yeah, now the invitation is filled with kibbeh and lahmadi. He's showing it to everybody. So the bartender says, oh, you're invited. We'll give you whatever you want. I can have anything I want. Yes, you're part of the wedding. He says, what? They give you free drink to the wedding? Give me two cokes, give me a Bloody Mary, give me a scotch, a beer, give me a white wine, a red wine. They make him a whole tray of drinks. He sits down and he's guzzling each drink. All of a sudden, the musicians enter. You know, in the lobby of the hotel, they have just a few musicians, one violinist and maybe a harpist. So he says, what is this? This is background music. Unbelievable. He takes his chair, he puts it right in front of the violinist, he has now his food, his drink, and he's enjoying, and he starts to dance, and he's enjoying life, and he says to his wife, how lucky are we? We're invited to the most lavish, to the most beautiful wedding, amazing. Now it's about 7 o'clock, the ceremony's taking place inside, and this guy's happy with life. He can't eat anymore, he can't drink anymore. He tells his wife, you know something? I'm hungry. I never ate so much, I never drank so much. I never heard so much music. Let's go back, we have to go back home, I'm too tired. All of a sudden he hears a bell, ding, 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 and the maitre d' comes out and says, ladies and gentlemen, you're now welcome to the wedding, we're going to open up the grand ballroom. And all of a sudden they open up the grand ballroom where the Waldorf is still, and the guy looks. He can't believe what he's seeing. He sees tables set up with centerpieces. Each table has three plates on top of each other, two forks, three spoons. Each plate has three or four glasses in front of it. He looks around, he sees bar stations 13 feet, 14 feet long on each corner of the ballroom. He looks on stage, he sees a 30-piece orchestra. And he sees the waiters bringing out entrees. That small little kibbeh bringing out filet mignon and steaks and chicken. And he sees a big chandelier in the center. And he turns to somebody and says, what's this? What's this? There's a wedding. This is the wedding? What was that? That was nothing. That was hors d'oeuvres. That was just, what are you talking about? I thought that was the wedding. Join us. I'm too tired. I can't. I celebrated already. I danced, I drank, I'm drunk, I have to go home, I'm sick. And our rabbis used to tell us, that's exactly us, we're that hick. We come into this world thinking that this is the party. And we're going, and we're traveling, and we're eating, and we're dancing, and we're singing, we're saying this is the greatest party ever. And we're indulging, and we're going after all of our earthly pleasures. And then all of a sudden there's going to come a time where God's going to ring the bell. All invited to Olam Abba. And they're going to open up and say, what? What is this? Say, you fool. You were dancing in the lobby. You were making a party in the courtyard. You thought that this is it? This is just a staging ground. It's a vestibule. You filled yourself up on the smorgasbord. Now there's no time for you to celebrate at the real wedding. You must always keep that in mind. Olam Hazeh Domeh Lefrozdor. We are going to live eternally. What's 120 years compared to eternity? How much is eternity? 100 billion years? No. 100 billion years is only 1 second in eternity. 300 zillion years, 1 second in eternity. It's nothing. It never ends. So what's 120 years compared to eternity? It's nothing. It's not even a millisecond. It's a nanosecond. It's nothing. Compared to our eternal existence, this little visit in this world is very temporary. When a person keeps that in mind, it'll curb his pleasure outside the class. In the class, God, I will do it. Outside the class, remembering what the Pasuk says, Vayachanu, Vayishu mikedrata tada. You know how you leave the craving of desire? Vayachanu b'haserot. You have to have the attitude that you're living in a haser, that you're living in a courtyard. That mental attitude of the temporary nature of this world will give you the ability to control yourselves. And I'm not only preaching, I'm retired ladies, I'm talking to myself as well. This is advice that every lady and every man must hear. You always must remember that. This is not the game. And I'll conclude with a story that my rabbi told us of some children that they were begging to go to Disney World their whole life. And their parents finally took them to Disney World and they got to the parking lot. And they thanked their parents, "Thank you, Mommy and Daddy, for taking us. We're so appreciative." And they got out of the car, they sat down in the parking lot, and they took out jacks. Remember the game jacks? A little ball and six jacks. And they started to play jacks in the parking lot of Disney World. And one kid says to his brother, "What a great time we're having. This is so great. Our parents are so good to us. Look what they did for us." And another kid says, "Yeah, wait, but I have a crossword puzzle also." "A crossword puzzle? Amazing. You wrote a crossword." And they're sitting in the parking lot of Disney, playing jacks and doing crossword puzzles. They turned to their parents and said, "What a great trip." And the parents can't believe it. "We brought you all the way over here. You think this is something, playing jacks in the parking lot? Behind those doors is the greatest theme park in the world. There's rides, there's roller coasters, there's entertainment. And you're already enjoying, you're relishing the fact that you're playing some ball in the parking lot of Disney. This is the parking lot, ladies. This over here is nothing. This is just over here to prepare. The theme park is all about that's already the gates. And all we have to do in this world is to prepare ourselves. So when they finally open the door, we're ready. And the only way to get ready is with Torah Mitzvot. That's the entry. You don't need an invitation. They're not going to ask us for an invitation. You're all invited. You just have to present your Torah, your good deeds, your prayers, your kindness, your parenting, your being good wives, all the mitzvot that you did, that's your entry. And the more you present, the better seat you get. The more you present, the better position you have to enjoy this eternal body. Ladies, you have your work cut out for you. The time is short. Hachem Baruch used to always enter our class in Magen David every day. God rest his soul. Bless his soul. The rabbi used to come to our class in Magen David every day. He used to tell us the same exact saying every morning for a year straight. Hayom kasar, v'amelacha meruba. The day is short, but the work is immense. And the rabbi was trying to tell us, boys, you have a big job ahead of you. It's a lot of work. It's insurmountable. There's 613 mitzvah. And the day is very short. And the rabbi was not only referring to the day, but he was referring to the day of our lives. The life is short and we have so much work to do. And therefore we must get busy. And when one person remembers that, all the other things go to the wayside because he has a mission, he has a goal. Then already all the other cravings become less important. I wish you success in your mission, success in your goals, and Be'ezrat Hashem will all join together when they open up the grand ballroom of Olam Haba. We won't be like that hick that already celebrated already. We'll be fresh and ready to enjoy an eternal existence. Amen.